When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical bill expert, finding savings can seem impossible. Well, HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. So start saving with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Thinking Sideways is not brought to you by Bad Hombres. Instead, it's brought to you by Stitcher Premium. Yeah, if you haven't heard of Stitcher Premium yet, well, you're missing out because that's where all the cool kids are these days. Yeah, you can listen to us on Stitcher.com, and you can hear our content 4 days early and ad-free. Isn't that not cool or what? Also, if you sign up for 12 months, you get a month off if you use our special promo code, which is you go to Stitcher.com/thinkingsideways, use the promo code sideways, and you will get that 1 month free. So to get all that, become a premium member, go out to Stitcher.com today and subscribe.
Well, hey there, and welcome to another episode of Thinking Sideways. I am Steve, as usual, joined by
Devin
and Joe.
And as per usual, what? I don't know. God, I hate saying what. Okay, whose fault is it I picked up the word huge? Is it you?
Yeah, it's their fault. It should be as per always.
As per usual, because like per usual always. Is not a word that you can abbreviate or shorten. Is not. As usual, we have another mystery for you this week. And it is a historical mystery. So it's we're getting off the murder train.
No. We're going to get back on. Don't worry.
Well, there is a lot of murder in the story.
That's true.
There's some killing here.
So this week we are going to talk about the historical mystery, which is, did anyone who was with Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer survive when he took the five companies of the 7th Cavalry that were under his command at that time into the Indian Territory near the Little Bighorn River in Montana on June 25th, 1876?
Yeah, and actually a lot of people survived the Little Bighorn.
Well, the people that were with Custer specifically didn't.
Yeah, those guys didn't.
We'll get into that.
So the title of this is going to be like an entire paragraph long?
It'll be very simple when I title it on the episode thing. So
Who was with Lieutenant Colonel George?
No.
that is kind of long. Not going to fit in an iPhone.
Let's get into the
story.
All right,
let's refocus. Sorry.
Actually, before we get into the story, I do need to thank our listener, Jonathan, who suggested this to us I think like 2 years ago or something like that.
Yeah. That's why it's a historical mystery.
There you go. So thank you, Jonathan. And let's pick up with the story. As people probably know, commonly the event that we're going to talk about is known as Custer's Last Stand.
I would say, yeah, in America.
Yeah, in America, but there
people
are people
about it, but
all over the rest of the world that have only heard of Custer
or,
and not really know a lot about
or
it.
Or not even heard of Custer, yeah.
I think we're saying custard wrong, and, you know.
It's Custer.
I know.
Yeah, George Custer.
Custard.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. I'm glad we clarified that. Made me look like an idiot.
Yeah.
All right.
That's my job.
So here's the story is that General Custer, he and all of his men in 1876, July 25 specifically, they went into Indian territory, and we'll get into the backstory of this, but they were killed by the Indians the American Indians, and we've had this conversation before. If you read it on the internet, some American Indians say, it's American Indian. And some say, just call me Indian. I don't care. So no. I'm going to use it interchangeably.
Sounds good.
Devin's giving me a dirty look for that.
Why?
I'm just thinking, I think it should be Native American, but
yeah, Indian.
Well, but
good.
That's the thing is that I've seen all over there's no consensus. Some people are like, I want to be Native America. Some people are like, I'm an Indian.
Yeah.
I mean, so
yeah.
I don't want to prescribe to one because
no, it's not. It's not
a
like
split opinion.
Yeah, that's not like it's a racial slur or anything like that.
Mm-mm.
And it's
okay.
I mean, essentially, Columbus went looking for India and Indians, and he found some. So there you go.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's start this portion of the episode over so that this doesn't make no sense to anybody. As people, as we've kind of said so far, people, at least in the America, in North America, will know this is referred to as Custer's Last Stand. And what happened is that Custer and all of his men were defeated and killed by the Lakota Sioux, the Dakota Sioux, the Cheyenne, and the Arapaho tribes that were camped by the river. This is the Little Bighorn River on June 25th, 1876. Now, Custer himself commanded approximately 200 men when he went into battle, and officially none of those 200 survived. But since almost immediately after Custer and his men were resoundingly defeated and killed, people have come forward and said they were there and they made it in some way. They made it out alive.
It's yeah, I was there.
Like, it's kind of like the people who say they knew D.B. Cooper, but unfortunately he just died 6 months ago. But hey,
yeah.
I wrote a book about it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's tons of, there's like 120 people over the years have come forward and said they were there.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of these people. And one of those people specifically, which is the focus of today's episode, is a man named Frank Finkel, who in 1920 announced that he had been part of the group that went into that territory with Custer specifically, and he managed to make it out alive. So that's our mystery, is Frank Finkel telling the truth?
Okay.
And was he among those 200 men?
So it's who finked on Frank Finkel.
Is it
not quite,
no that doesn't work because is it Finkel's finking or
yeah.
no
well,
Joe you
say,
got you,
I could say would, did Finkel fink on himself
yeah
and in a sense
it's Finkel
it
finking
be, yeah because yeah Finkel
what
finking
were you
because,
thinking
yeah,
ha okay sorry
because he could be it could be construed as desertion
mm-hmm.
in the face of the enemy so you know according to his story he didn't actually desert but
no. No, that's very true.
Yeah, we're gonna
although he sort
that,
of
right?
kind of did.
Well, but we'll get into we'll get into the repercussions of that and the positives and negatives and all of that. So listen, this is a historical mystery. So there's a bunch of history that I have to try and lay out for everybody listening.
But only in three sentences. So it'll
well,
be
but
merciful.
That's the difficulty is there's so much here. I'm going to do my best to keep this as condensed as possible. But that means, of course, that I'm going to have to omit and simplify some information. So if you are an aficionado of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, please understand that's what's going on here.
Rest assured, Steve knows.
Yeah, because listen, we did the whole football thing, and football nerds are nowhere near as mean as history nerds.
Oh, yeah.
So
this picky.
Could get really dirty, but just understand, we know that we're trimming it down because that's not the main point of the story.
Right.
Yep,
okay.
Yep.
So here's where we go. before the Battle of the Little Bighorn, of course, when Europeans came to North America, they immediately began pushing around the native people, the indigenous peoples.
Well, I wouldn't say immediately, just eventually.
Pretty damn quick, but yeah. they started pushing them around for things that they wanted, and that ended up meaning that they pushed them off of their ancestral homes, and through the reservation system, they began relocating them to other places that they were not previously living upon.
Yeah, but that, again, it didn't happen. That took centuries before that actually happened.
This is simplifying as much as possible, because we're not going to get into the ethics of why that happened. And
I'm not saying it was fair, no.
Through the lens of history, probably was a bad thing, not the best thing to do.
Definitely a bad thing, yeah.
So, we move forward, and I mean, if you want to get in sense, like, I don't know if you two had a chance to do this, but I did some reading on things like the Trail of Tears, which is very famous. And if you do reading on that, you get a real sense of what it was like for the Native Americans to go through that.
Yeah,
so,
they're really awful stuff.
Yeah, really bad, really bad. Okay, so then what we do is, as we move forward through time, there becomes notable names, and names that you may have heard before, such as Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse.
They are some of the famous ones.
They are some of the famous ones, and at least Sitting Bull will play a major role in our stories. Crazy Horse was there, apparently, as well. But these guys were both leaders of the Sioux, and the Sioux lived in the Great Plains. If people don't know what the Great Plains is, it's essentially
the center. It's a big flat spot in the middle of the middle.
Yeah, the center of North America, north to south. It's really kind of a giant flat spot.
It's great big. That's why they call it the Great Plains.
It's the flyover states.
It is.
All of them.
Yeah.
So these guys in the mid 1800s, they began speaking out against the U.S. government. And the government, of course, is at this point, as I've said before, they're pushing people around, they're pushing them out. The other thing they're doing is they're breaking treaties, and that's going to play into this story very strongly.
Yes.
That's where the term Indian giver comes from.
Yes, actually, because you give and then you take it back.
You give, you change your mind, you take it back.
Actually, I'm pretty sure that's a derogatory term. What's so weird about that derogatory term is that it's based on white people.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing.
But it makes a negative connotation.
Well, no, I mean, it's not like, since I was a kid, it was understood as not something derogatory towards the Indians. I mean, some people today, misconstruing the history of that phrase, have claimed it's a slur against the Indians. It never has been. It's
not. That's my point, though, for people who don't know the history,
it becomes
a slur.
Yeah, some people now think that it is, and it's not.
Yeah.
It is.
It's actually a negative thing towards us white folk.
Or at least Americans.
Yeah. So here's what happens, though, is that the Native Americans are pushed into a reservation. This is in South Dakota. And then in 1875, gold is found in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And
which the Indians had no use for, so hey, let's kick them off their land, the U.S. government
going, what the hell? Like, these Indians are not harvesting it. They're just living on that ground. That's dumb.
Just respecting the earth or whatever.
That's right. So we might as well push them off, find them a new home.
That's exactly what happens is they say, wait, no, we're going to move you now because we're going to change the deal.
Again.
And we're going to move you somewhere else. And I think the plan was they were moving them, and please don't, I don't remember the exact location because this is such a muddy history, but pretty sure that was where they were then moving them to what is the modern day Crow Reservation in Montana.
Now, I had thought that the Crows were supposed to keep their reservations and that they were going to actually give them some more land. They weren't going to move them onto the Crow Reservation, but what touched off this particular confrontation is that many of the other tribes were encroaching on the Crow land.
So the Crows, in
this particular battle, it took place on the Crow reservation in Montana.
But
those other tribes were not actually supposed to be there. The Crows did not want them there.
This is the difficulty with this whole thing, is there's so much back and forth.
Well, and it's tough to keep track of the tribes. And the other thing to remember too about the tribes is that a lot of them hated each other, and so that's one of the reasons that in the end they wind up losing everything, because if they had actually banded together, you know, they might have stood more of a chance.
Well,
and
that was what
territory.
Some of the great leaders of the Indian nations were trying to do, was band them together.
But some of these tribes had hatreds going back a long, long way.
They were just, you know, big family feuds, basically.
Pretty much.
It's not unusual. I mean, it's what people do everywhere. I mean, there's people that have similar hatreds back in Europe and other places, too. It's not unusual. But,
no, not at all. Yeah. So they're going to get moved. So the idea is that these people in South Dakota, is at least as I understand it, the plan is to push them up into Montana. And a lot of the tribes would resist that. Not all of them, but a lot of tribes would. So some would go and some would say no, and they would run away and they would disappear into this untamed land because, you know, it's not as if it's a metropolitan area.
Yeah.
So they can just take off. And then later on, tribes would then say, you know, we really don't like what you're doing to us, and so we're going to leave the reservations, which is Sitting Bull. He let a huge contingent off of the reservation in protest. So this is how, this is kind of the turmoil or the back setting of what's going on at the time in the area.
Yeah, so things were tense between a lot of these tribes in the U.S. Army.
Yeah, they were. I would say it was tense between everybody.
I was going to say tense might be like an understatement.
Yeah, although the crows were on our side. They actually helped out. They actually tried to help Custer a bit, but not too much. But,
they were allied
with Custer and the gang, but. Didn't work out that well.
Yeah,
anyway.
and that's a great segue there, Joe. Let's move to Custer and the Gang, which, by the way, would be a great band name. So if we move away from the Native peoples and we move to the U.S. Army or the military, between March and May of 1876, several infantry and cavalry companies were sent. And these were all from different locations. They were sent to patrol along the Yellowstone River heading towards Montana. And they were supposed to look for hostile natives, particularly Sioux.
The ones that were off the reservation.
Right.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to look for him. And Custer himself, now Custer would be part of a series of larger contingents of military groups, but Custer had about 600 men underneath him in the 7th Cavalry. And like I said, I mean, those other groups were there. So there's other infantry and cavalry. And there's a lot of different generals whose names I could list off, and you might or might not know them. There's a whole bunch of other companies within each unit, which is hard to keep straight because they use alpha. It's not alphanumeric. It's alpha characters to keep to order them.
Yeah, so A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
So you could have Company E 7 times between all of these groups. So it gets confusing.
It's actually not so important to the
story. So the point is, it's a large group. I mean, we're talking 1,500 military, U.S. military, I'm ballparking this.
But not present there that day, though.
No, this is between all of the divisions that were all moving along the Yellowstone River at once.
Yeah, but the ones that were at the Little Bighorn was like, what, more like 600, 700?
With Custer, it would have been 600.
600, okay.
Okay, so 8 days prior to the Battle of the Little Bighorn, another incident took place, and that was the Battle of the Rosebud. And this was on the Rosebud Creek, as I understand it. And
the Rosebud was a little sleigh that belonged to a very rich guy.
Wrong story, Jeff.
Oh, really?
I was going to say Rosebud is the code you used for infinite money.
Yeah, wrong one there, too.
It is.
Oh, okay.
This is a little creek, which, by the way, I looked for Rosebud Creek, and I can't find it anymore, so I'm pretty sure it's been renamed.
Or it doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it may have dried up or been diverted or filled in. Who knows? But what happens is the Battle of Rosebud is that several cavalry and infantry companies encounter a unexpectedly large congregation of American Indians, and those U.S. forces are pushed back and basically have to retreat. I mean, they were defeated, essentially. And then what happens is they encounter days later these divisions that had been sent up the Yellowstone River, including Custer's 7th.
And that was a very large group of Indians.
Yes.
Extremely large.
Yes. So we might as well give that away now, is the initial numbers, everybody thought that what they were going to encounter was going to be somewhere in the low hundreds, maybe the like 500-ish. What it turned out to be was about 1,500 to 2,500 warriors, as I understand it.
Uh-huh.
Which okay, so lot. That's a huge scale.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And when you combine that with the fact that at least a couple of hundred of them, I believe, were armed with repeating rifles, and the cavalry had single-shot Springfield trapdoor rifles.
It's one of those things in history that you look back and you go, what the hell was going on? Because somebody got a good contract and the military started getting their guns from them. And so all of these repeating weapons were then turned around and sold to the American Indians.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, why did you think single shot was so much better than a repeating? It doesn't make any sense.
A lot of them, some of them, the ones that were getting sold to the Indians were these lever action Henry rifles that were chambered in things like 44 and 45 caliber.
Okay.
They were essentially pistol calibers. And so not great long range weapons.
And so the
Springfield had a longer, it was in a much more yeehaw cartridge, had much better range. But same time, for a close-in engagement like this, I would much rather have a
lever-action Henry,
rather than a single shot. Yeah, hell yeah.
That's what I mean. That's what it's like.
And also, by the way, there's another factor in this battle is that Custer actually was moving fast and light, and left his supply train behind. They were still trying to catch up. They had all the ammunition. I shouldn't say all. I mean, his men all had some on
them.
And
we'll get into some of that. Yeah. So here's what happens is, I know we've jumped ahead a little bit, but the simplified version of this is that Custer and the 7th Cavalry, they move up Rosebud Creek, and they're looking for this contingent of Native Americans. They find them, but as we've said, Custer is fed wrong information. He's told when he gets there that, oh, at the best, there's 800 warriors. Again, we're saying it turns out it's more like 1,500, 2,500.
Plus, they're better armed than you are.
It doesn't appear he knew that, at least from my reading.
Yeah, a lot of people have criticized Custer's behavior, but I think he did just get some bad intel.
The other problem is that he was then given... He thought, here's what the plan was. Custer had separated from all these other groups of U.S. soldiers because the plan was they were all going to circle around what is now called the Crow's Nest. That's where the battle took place. And the idea is they were going to hit him from multiple sides on the same day, basically just swarm in and surround the enemy and decimate them. And he was like, yeah, there's a bunch of them and we could probably take them out, but that's no big deal. We'll just hang out. Except then he's given information. Oh, wait, it turns out that there are Indian scouts following our trail to where we are, meaning...
Yeah, preparing for battle.
Meaning, we're going to get attacked on both sides.
Or he just decided he needed to attack before they got word back that he was there.
Problem was...
Yeah, and so he'd lose the element of surprise, so he decided to rush his schedule just a little bit.
Problem, of course, in hindsight,
they weren't spies. It turns out
what they said was scouts was actually people who were leaving the congregation that he was watching, and they were just happened to cross the path that they had walked, and they were leaving. So it's, again, another instance of Custer getting bad information. I believe that we can just now call this the Custer cluster.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much not right with what he's doing.
Or the Custer...
Yeah,
you can call it that too.
Yeah. So let's just simplify this and shorten this up as much as we can. So Custer says, okay, they're gonna get us. We need to attack, and he takes his group of 600 men and he splits them into three units, 200 apiece, and they split off in multiple directions. Yeah. And Custer's group goes in. They eventually, we don't, by the way, know exactly what happened. People have been arguing over this for years.
That's another mystery, is nobody really does know what happened at that particular battle. And there's a lot of conflicting information. But it's a great mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Custer and his men, they head through, they head north, they encounter this much larger enemy contingent than they expect. They're pushed farther north, and the enemy would then go ahead and surround Custer and that group of 200 men that he brought with him, and they would massacre all of them. Every single man would be killed.
Yeah, what's called Custer's Last Stand.
Yeah, and that's why it's called Custer's Last Stand, exactly. So in the group, this is pretty impressive, is everybody that died besides Custer is we have his two brothers would be killed, his nephew would die, his brother-in-law would die, almost every horse that was involved would be killed, all of Custer's dogs would be killed.
The Indians
killed
his dogs?
Oh, and by the way, the other 196 men would die as well.
I can't believe those jerks killed his dogs. That's
rude. Actually, it's a little surprising they killed the horses.
Well, actually, I think that a lot of those guys killed their own horses so they could use them for cover.
Probably. They did. They made barricades. They would try to build barricades out of horses. Also, when there's
a lot of... The Indians probably would have kept the horses.
When there's a lot of lead flying around...
It's just easy for the horse to get taken out. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, that's kind of the way that the whole story goes. And people say, well, why didn't he get help? Because, of course, Custer sent for help. Well, he sent multiple dispatches. But what happens is that people have to go many, many miles back. And if they go to the
other... If they make it.
Yeah. And then there's the other groups that they're trying to get information to. Those other groups were at least 65 miles away. This is rugged terrain. As Joe said before, he left his supply chain behind. So that's dozens of miles back. Like, it takes a long time. It's not like today where you just hop in your car and zip down there in 2 minutes and zip back.
Well, there was, there was a big controversy too that, because he split up, as you said, into three groups.
Yeah.
The other two groups, Southern Majors, Reno and Benteen, went off in different directions. Mm-hmm. One of the controversies surrounding that is, why didn't those guys come to his aid? And there are actually a lot of people accuse them of cowardice and of not,
And see, I disagree with that because I think they were so far away.
Then they had those other guys had their hands full. I mean, they were under attack too. So, but I mean, a lot of people said that.
No. Well, yeah, it wasn't like they were just tooling down the road. Nah,
they hear all the gunshots and screaming from over there on the hill. They're just like, he's got it.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have, I've led you a little astray, dear listener, as I like to do. There, other than Mr. Finkel or any of the other 120 people who have claimed to be survivors, there is one confirmed survivor of this whole thing.
And
that is Comanche.
Mm. Yeah. The horse.
The horse, yes.
Yeah.
Comanche was a horse that was ridden by one of the guys in the group, and the horse was found wounded days later and nursed back to health. Comanche would live for another 15 years, and he would die at the ripe old age of 29.
That's pretty good.
That is for a horse. Very good. And by the way, this horse was given a full military funeral. He's one of three horses that have gotten a full military funeral. Mm. Unfortunately, those sadists did not bury Comanche. Instead, they stuffed him. I think it is. But he is now in the University of Kansas's National History Museum. So,
I got to remember that if I'm back there in Kansas sometime.
Poor Comanche.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't care. I was going to say it's to survive something like this. It's more than a matter of just playing dead. Because, I mean, usually what happened after a battle like this, the women would go through the battlefield with these big war clubs and just cave everybody's head in, so you couldn't just, play possum and hope to survive that way.
Because, I don't want to say this, and I don't want to come out derogatory, and I can't remember the exact pronunciation, but I believe it's where they they were taking scalps.
Yeah.
So that was something that happened, as far as I understand it, especially in this, specifically in this instance. So that you can't fake. You can't just lay there.
You can't play
and take
possum
it.
When they're peeling your scalp off.
No,
wouldn't work.
But let's get back into the main line here. So we've got the original event, and then several days later after the battle, Which, by the way, was a resounding success and victory for the Native Americans.
Yep.
Yep.
The U.S. forces would return to the area, and they would try to find everybody who'd been killed and figure out what the hell had happened.
I think this was before dog tags were invented.
I'm pretty sure it was.
That would have been handy to have some dog tags.
As Joe said, some very horrible things were done to the bodies after they were killed, and then they were left to sit in the hot summer sun for at least a day or two.
I thought it was more like 3 days, but yeah,
it depends. But
yeah.
I mean, it really, that makes it extremely hard to identify a body when all of that has been done to it and then it's been roasting for a couple
of
days.
Well, and you know, scavengers.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens is these guys show up, they try to identify anybody that they can, they quickly dig graves and they shove the bodies in there, and then they get out of there because they presume that the forces that have done this are still in the area, and they don't want to be found out, and they don't want
to
suffer the same fate.
Yeah.
So they do their job as quickly as they can, and then they vamoose.
Actually, it's pretty brave of them to stick around as long as they did.
Agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that whole thing, as we've said before, that was June of 1876. We're now going to jump forward. We're going to jump forward to 1920, which is 44 years later. We're going to go to Dayton, Washington.
Hey,
which
just
is,
north of here.
Yeah, Pacific Northwest.
Oh.
A local and rather successful farmer named Frank Finkel in 1920 announced that he had, in fact, been at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and he was in that group that Custer commanded, and he had actually managed to make it out alive. Now, his reasons for bringing the story forward at that time, well, it varies from source to source. Some say that he was having drinks with drinking beer and playing horseshoes, and somebody started talking bad about Custer, and he came forward to defend him, and that's how his story came out. There's another version that says that he was at a presentation about Custer and the Battle of the Little Bighorn where wrong details were presented, and he then came forward to correct those details. I don't know which it is.
Yeah.
But from there, Frank would then get a whole bunch of attention, as you would probably expect.
Yeah.
And he'd be interviewed by newspapers, and he would start to share his story at different talks around the area. Mm. That was in 1920 that he came forward.
Uh-huh. And that's it. And just to put it in perspective, there were still a lot of people alive in 1920 who remembered the battle.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't necessarily
there.
It's 44
years old.
Yeah, it's not that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that long ago. It's I'm trying to think of what was the one that we had in South America in the 80s with Nicaragua? No. What's the guy whose wife collected all the shoes?
Oh yeah, you're talking about the Philippines.
Panama.
The Philippines. No, that was what's your name?
Mark. Anyway.
Yeah, Marcos. Yes.
But that's the same
Fernando
thing.
Marcos.
Is it like that was about 40 years ago?
Actually, D.B. Cooper was like 47 years ago.
Yeah. So, not that long ago in the popular memory.
No.
So totally. As I said, though, he came forward in 1920 with his story. In 1921, his wife, Delia, would pass away.
Hmm.
He would remarry a woman named Hermie. She then obviously is referred to everywhere as Hermie Finkel.
Mm-hmm.
They got married in 1926, and then Frank himself would die in 1930, so 10 years after he came forward. So he died at the age of 76, which means he came forward at the age of 66.
So he would have been in his 20s.
Yeah.
So he would have been the age at least works.
Yeah.
Okay.
The math, generally speaking,
at
works.
Least that.
Yes.
That's a start.
Yes. It's not as if he was a 20-year-old dude saying I was there, and you're like, no, you weren't, dummy.
Or, you know, he was age 17
or he was age
14.
Six. Yeah.
Right. So the math, generally speaking, should work.
Okay.
There are multiple stories out there about Frank's origin story, and part of that seems to maybe be because of his second wife, Hermie, because after he died, she remarried. She married a man and then moved to Oshkosh,
Bagosh.
Wisconsin. Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Yeah. I knew that was going to happen. And they were not well off in terms of money, and she needed extra money, so she filed for a veteran's widow pension, and she kept pushing on it for many years, so...
Yeah, they didn't buy the story.
No, they never gave her a dime. She died in 1951, I think it was. So she worked on this for a long time.
Was she much younger then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She was much younger than he was. It appears that maybe she was attracted to him for his fame of his story.
Okay.
Because at that point, he would have been a 70-year-old man. Marrying a maybe 30-something-year-old lady,
yeah, or maybe 20-something.
It's so you can see it's maybe not a true loving relationship in that regard, a romantic relationship. That's the way to put it.
Yeah.
So there are several versions of Frank Finkel's story out there, though, his origin story. And here are the main three that you'll come across in the reading. Version one, Frank was born in Ohio to German immigrant parents, and his parents spelled their last name F-I-N-C-K-L-E, so Finkel or Finkel?
Probably still Finkel, just...
Yeah. Maybe, but they appear to have dropped the C later on while he was still a boy, and they changed to Finkel, as you'll see in a lot of places, F-I-N-K-L-E. He would grow up to be fluent in both English and German because he lived with German parents. And then when he became a young adult, he moved away from home to find his way in the world in Chicago in 1872. On hard times, he enlisted in the U.S. Army as a way to earn a living. He knew that German soldiers were coveted by the U.S. Army, and so he changed his name on his paperwork to August Finkel, F-I-N-C-K-L-E. He would say he was from Berlin, Prussia, and he would tell them that his occupation was a clerk.
Why would he do that?
From Prussia?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's a weird thing that I didn't get for a long time, but it turns out that the Prussian Wars had been going on for a while, and German soldiers were coveted because that meant that they had been in battle, so they wouldn't freeze up.
Okay.
Whereas a lot of the Americans who would enlist, the first time gunpowder would go off, they'd pee their pants and freeze up.
Well, understandably.
Yeah, and the
Prussians... I'm not discrediting of that, but...
But yeah.
Yeah, the Prussians were actually pretty formidable soldiers, too.
Yeah, they had a lot of grit, and that was something you would want to bring on board to make your army that much stronger.
Okay.
That's version one. So then he says, I'm a clerk. He would then eventually rise through the ranks of the Custer's 7th Cavalry. And so that's how he would be then in the place that he said he was at the time he said he was. Okay. Version number two is that Frank Finkel was born in Germany under his given name at birth of August Finkel, F-I-N-C-K-L-E. He then emigrated to the U.S. and enlisted in the U.S. Army in the early 1870s. But it turns out he wasn't that great of a soldier, and he wasn't very well liked by the guys that he was enlisted with because his accent was so thick and his grammar was so bad that most people couldn't understand him, including the native German speakers that he would encounter.
And this is why, this particular version, I don't buy it, because I could just imagine that gathering in 1920 when, you know, he suddenly says, y'all... Jawohl, I for that sabato of a little big horn. How many people are going to buy that, right?
I don't even know what you just said.
He said, yeah, I was a survivor of the little big horn.
Oh, see?
That was with my Mitte German accenta.
See, I believed it, though, because I didn't understand it.
So I actually a little bit can't, I know we're not really like debating this yet, but I can a little bit buy that his accent might have been super, super thick if he was trying to convince people that he was August Finkel,
born from Germany,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he was faking the accent. The American when he was speaking English, but then he was not maybe so fluent in German, or his German accent was really bad, and so the native German speakers were like, dude, what?
You suck.
I can't understand this guy. You're not speaking German. What are you doing? You know, he's just like speaking garbledy goop at them.
Yeah, garbledy goop. Yeah. That's the best description yet.
I can kind of buy that.
Okay. Yeah. So version 3 is basically the same as version 1, except instead of enlisting under the name of Auguste, he instead enlists under the name Frank Hall. And that whole story comes out from Hermie, because that is the story that she stuck to the entire time that she was working to get the pension.
I kind of like Frank Hall better because it's easier to spell.
I mean, it makes sense that, you know, she would have used the name that he told her he was registered under.
Yeah.
Yeah. If that's what he told her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is the hard part, because I don't know what he said and what she said and what people have implied and shoehorned into this whole story. Listen, we're very close to theories, so let me run through the remainder of Frank's story.
Oh, he's still got more stories?
Yeah, believe me, this is a story-heavy episode, because we got a half a page here to go.
Okay.
So whatever version of the story is correct, or closest to correct, they all converge on essentially the same series of events on the day of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Frank said that he was riding his horse just like every other man and that day, and fighting and shooting, and his rifle was hit with a bullet. And specifically, the wooden stock of his rifle was hit. So the stock exploded and he was struck with a piece of wood in the head. Sometimes it said he was struck between the eyes, sometimes just somewhere in the face. But the versions always kind of seem to iterate that, or infer that what happens is he's either knocked out or he is completely coated in blood and basically knocked out.
And maybe a little, maybe stunned.
Yes, stunned.
Not so much knocked out.
So he's
out.
Just coated in blood. At the same time, his horse is also hit in the flank, which, if you don't know, the flank of a horse is the rib cage, the side. So it panics. It bolts into the line of oncoming enemy forces, this line of American Indians, and blows through the line. And they think, well, it's obviously a dead guy on a horse, because look at all the blood on him. But while he's going through the line, he's shot twice. He's shot once in the foot and once in the shoulder, or maybe in the abdomen. We don't know which, because again, I don't know. He was shot twice. And he keeps going, and his horse keeps running, and he eventually comes to, and then he wanders in the wilderness for several days until his horse gives out. And he says, as mercy, he shot the horse to put it out of its misery.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
He then wanders on foot with a shot foot. But he wanders on foot for several more days until he comes upon a cabin with a guy outside chopping wood. And the guy starts yelling at him, get out of here. And what does he do? He passes out.
Mm. Just like in the movies.
Yes. He wakes up. He's now in the cabin. The man has treated his wounds. And he comes to discover that he is in a cabin with a man named Bill. That's the man who he saw and who treated his wounds. There is another man in the cabin who is very ill and dying from tuberculosis.
Just the kind of guy you want to share a cabin with.
Yep. Yeah. Frank does not ever get this guy's name, and Bill tells them that they are trappers. Then the second man dies, and Frank is now well enough to move on his own, and so they part ways, which is weird. I have heard versions of this, or, you know, people reading into it and saying, you know, what probably is that these guys weren't actually trappers.
Probably not.
They were probably gun runners or whiskey runners.
Yeah.
And who knows what the other guy died of. It might have been tuberculosis. He might have been shot and Frank just didn't know it.
There's a lot of stuff that could get you back in those days. Oh. Stuff that would be easily treatable today. But I think Finkel said, too, that when he was there, he didn't see anything resembling a trap anywhere inside or outside the cabin.
Yeah.
So that kind of like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah. It's very weird. But from this point, though, Finkel wanders back to civilization. And he discovers that, oh, wait, everybody that was with Custer that day was killed. And one of two things happens. Again, this is depending on the version of the story that you read. He either said, uh-oh, I can't tell anybody who I am because they're going to call me a deserter and they're going to kill me because deserters were known to be shot for deserting.
Yeah.
It was a
for
huge
sure.
crime. Or the other version, which I find absurdly funny because it's absurd, is that he reports to some officer at some station and says, this is who I am. And then officer says, oh, okay, great. Well, I'll need you to provide evidence, and that evidence will be in the form of two witnesses. And he says, oh, well, they're all dead.
Yeah.
So, okay, he about faces and he heads off west to start his life anew.
I mean,
like everybody else in those days.
Yeah.
I mean, that sure. I'll just say, though, that it seems unlikely that he could not produce two single people, especially if he rose through the ranks.
There should have been people in the other
There
units.
Should have been other there people were, yeah, who would have been able to say, yep.
Yeah.
There were a lot of survivors from the Little Bighorn.
Well, yeah, they of the 600, only 200 died of Customer 7.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You would think that. But no, instead, he just beats feed. He heads to the Pacific Northwest. He meets his Delia, who he marries, has three kids with her, and becomes a very, very wealthy man, a wealthy farmer, and keeps his mouth shut up until 1920.
When he probably figured nobody could do anything about it, so it didn't matter.
I'm guessing that if that's the reason that he finally spilled the beans, that's why he spilled the beans.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But that's our story. And so now, after all of this time, it's time to actually get into theories.
Yeah.
But before we do that, let's have a quick word from our sponsors.
Hey there, Joe from Thinking Sideways here, here to tell you why I'm such a big fan of SimpliSafe Home Security. And it's because SimpliSafe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If you know me, and you probably do, you know I'm ready for anything, right? I'm a prepper. I like to be prepared. So if a storm takes out your power, SimpliSafe is ready with a backup. If an intruder cuts your phone line, SimpliSafe is ready. If they destroy your keypad or your siren or your alarm, SimpliSafe will still get you the help you need. And here's what I love about this. Maybe this is overkill, but you don't need to be ready for every worst-case scenario. But SimpliSafe, on the other hand, is always ready for that, just in case. And that's what makes it so awesome. For a paranoid person like me, it's the bee's knees. Now, SimpliSafe could cost you an arm and a leg, and it probably should. That'd be fair. But it doesn't, actually. That's because they're good people. They charge you what's fair. Well, they charge you less than what's fair, really. It's only $14.99 a month. There's no contracts, no hidden fees. I recommend it to everyone I know, and I recommend it to you right now. You got to check it out. So go today to simplisafe.com/sideways. That's SimpliSafe, that's SimpliSafe.com/sideways.
And we're back.
Bills paid.
Bills paid. Let's get into theories. So there's really just two theories here.
Yeah.
I mean,
there was or he wasn't. Right?
Yeah. I mean, this is the simplest theory set ever, but there's a lot of different details. So we're just going to run through all of the parts of theory number one, and then we'll run through all of the parts of theory number two. By the way, the things in theory number one are going to mirror the things in theory number two.
Surprise.
Because they are flip sides of the same coin. So don't be surprised if we talk about one thing and then later on we're talking about it again. So the first theory is, of course, that he was in fact there.
Sure.
It's not unheard of for men who are in very bloody, violent confrontations to then not talk about those things for many, many, many years.
Well, he might have been a bit ashamed of what happened. He probably felt like, you know, even if he was totally blameless in his own mind, he felt like not everybody would see it that way.
It's true.
Yeah.
What's funny is I was actually talking to a friend just this weekend who his dad, I know that I did a Vietnam story last week, but it just happened to be coincidental, is that his dad served in the Vietnam War. He brought home a footlocker. That footlocker has been locked the entire time that this guy has known. His dad has died years ago, but his mom is still alive. And his mom has sworn that until she dies, they won't unlock lock that footlocker. Hmm. Like,
because it's full of human ears, probably.
I really don't think that's it. But the point is, like, some people are just so shook up and messed up by the things they experience and see that they have to lock them away in that way. And some guys just never talk about it. And some take 4 decades to actually be able to talk about it.
I think it'd be hilarious if, you know, when it finally is time to open that up, it's just nothing but, you know, like some comic books and maybe, an old pair of shoes, you know.
Are you talking about my friend with the Vietnam stuff?
Yeah,
it's going to be all rotted. It's so old.
It's actually just going to be a note that says, tricked you.
Yeah, ha ha.
I like that.
Yeah.
And not a locker full of black mold.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move through this theory, though. So there is one person in here who seems to support the fact that maybe Frank was there. This Frank was actually there, and that is a gentleman by the name of Charles Windolf. Windolf said that he was a friend of Frank Finkel. There was, by the way, a guy in Custer's 7th that had the name Finkel. So there is a guy that appears to maybe be in line with this. So Windolf says that he knew Frank Finkel, and when he went through the remains that were on the battlefield, he couldn't find his friend. Hmm. And his friend should have been identifiable because he was the tallest man in the 7th. He was the biggest man in the 7th.
Okay.
I mean, if you remember, this is 100 years ago, and with nutrition being what it was and yada, yada, yada.
Six footers were not that common.
No, six footers were rare and big guys were rare. So to be a large, tall man was uncommon.
And that's what Finkel was.
And Finkel, according to this, was a 6-foot-plus heavy man. I believe that Windolf is the one who tells the story that Finkel's horse would slow down and fall behind everybody else.
Because he was too dang heavy.
Because he was too dang heavy on too small of a horse. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, that's interesting because the horse really found his reserves of energy when the time came. All of a sudden, bam.
Yep, exactly. So he says that he went through the site, he looked for it, he should have been able to find the body of this very large man, no matter what the locals had done to the body, never mind the effects of the heat of the summer sun.
Right. He was a totally different body type than...
Correct, and he never found that body in among all of the bodies that were left. Now, if you look at, there are some pictures of our Frank Finkel standing. So the famous one that you see is always him and his wife. I believe it's Delia. They're sitting together in a swing.
Yeah, the first wife.
Yeah, but there are pictures of him standing with a cigar in his mouth. And I can't remember what kind of hat he has on, but it's such 1920s style. And he just looks like he's of that era. And I believe he's got the suit vest on and the suit jacket and all that. But he looks like, based on that image, he looks like a pretty tall, imposing dude.
Yeah, he looks big.
And so when I saw that, initially I was like, whatever. And then I saw that and I was started reading the accounts. Like, okay, well, maybe he really is the same guy because he seems to sort of fit that profile. Now, back in, it was 5 years ago, there was a photo that came out in some publications, so that would have been 2013, that said that it was a photo of Sergeant August Finkel from the 7th.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Okay. Yes. And it was saying, this is him. People these people who make their living looking at photos and comparing things, and there's this whole host of professions that do that, but the point is they looked at that, and they looked at a picture of our Frank Finkel from about 10 years later to compare the two, and they said, yeah, other than the effects of age... This is the same man. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we say it's the same guy. So there's that photographic evidence that seems to support the story. There are stories, if we move into another vein of the he was there, there are stories from the American Indians who were in the fight And by the way, they called, apparently, I didn't know this, but they would sometimes call the Americans long spears. And I'm guessing that was based on the rifles that
probably
they were using.
A spear that could really reach out and touch it from a distance.
Okay, long spear. Long spears. I didn't get it. I was like, I don't know why they call them long spears. Because it's a long gun, but that makes way more sense.
Yeah.
So they would call them long spears. And there was the stories about long spears breaking, you know, charging the line in this kind of suicidal run. And there were some that would break through. Well, there are at least one that they said broke through and they never got to because either they didn't go after him soon enough or they just said, yeah, that guy looks totally dead. You know, as in a man strapped to a horse that is dead because that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have been on a horse, right?
Yeah.
In a saddle?
Yeah. It just kind of seems like, if he had, especially if he had been knocked unconscious and, you know, was bloody, he's going to look dead.
And he's flopping about.
And he's going to, and unconscious or dead, he's going to fall off the horse shortly. So, why waste energy on that when you got, you know,
people to
kill?
If you think about it, the natural position for a man, when a body goes limp, it falls forward onto the withers and the horn of the withers of the horse and the horn of the saddle. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be draped across the neck of the horse and you're just going to literally flop about. If your feet are in the stirrups just right though, you might not fall out. And so I'm sure that I can see how they would see a guy like that. Arms just flapping about, you know, bouncing around. Bloody as hell and going, oh yeah, no, that dude, totally dead. Don't worry about it, just let it through. I can get behind that one.
Or was a lot of other things they had to pay attention to.
Well, and there were other things. There were women and younger men behind the lines that could probably take care of this wounded soldier anyway, so
and they
why
were the
worry?
Ones that would go after it wasn't the guys in the front line that would stop and turn around and chase him down.
No, they got to maintain their focus.
It was the women and the young men and the boys, even the boys and the girls, who would turn around and then track that horse, because there were stories of men who would get through and they would be tracked all the way down and killed. But there is this one that they never found. And so that kind of lends a little credence to Mr. Finkel.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of coincidences, but okay.
Yep, you're right. It's a lot of coincidences. Let's move on to another section of this, which is there are researchers who have looked at the details that our Frank Finkel gave about the events of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And they have said that he had to have been there because he gave details that the layman should not have known and been able to provide without either having been there or read the official accountings.
Yeah, there's probably, they didn't have Wikipedia back in those days, but there probably were ways to find out that information.
But that's a serious dedication to the...
Back in those days, it'd be harder to find out.
Well, and you'd have to come up with the idea of, you know what, I think I'm going to tell people that I was at Custer Stand. All right, let's go do this. Do a bunch of research, like spend a lot of time formulating this story to make it believable. And that's like...
It could have been his pet hobby.
I mean,
okay, let me flip sides real quick, though. Okay, it could have been his pet hobby, and he collected every detail he could. And there are guys that do this about everything from sports to random historical events. Yeah. And they developed this encyclopedic knowledge based on every single thing that they read.
Yeah.
And that is what some people, to counter what this theory, this part of the theory says, is there are people out there who say, yeah, no, it turns out that what he said wasn't all that revelatory. Mm-hmm. And all he did was stitch it together in a nice narrative.
Yeah.
And that's what really roped folk in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about that portion of it. If we move on, though, to Finkel's German?
Yeah.
Okay, which was crap?
Yeah,
remember that whole, he was unintelligible crap? Like
gobbledygook.
Talking with a mouthful of rocks? Unintelligible?
Yeah, gobbledygook.
Right. So people have said, well, that's probably actually what was going on, because if he was the child of immigrants, that means he was learning the language only from his parents. This is the theory, by the way, not that he was in a larger community, but just his parents. So he learned poorly. he would have almost been talking in pigeon German,
like
baby German, like baby talk. And so it was just so horrendous.
Well, or, you know, they could have been speaking a dialect.
That's kind of what I'm
thinking.
You know,
they could have been from a small village that had a German dialect, and that's what they taught him. And
true.
I mean, I know that's, you know, some of my family who still lives in Italy, they're the oldest generations of them. You know, people who speak just Italian don't understand them quite as well as they would, because they have this dialect. It's a regional dialect, and, you know, it's pretty much the same, but there are some concepts that are like, what are you? No.
It's like French and Patois.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
they're super close, but if you don't know, then it becomes
hard
to follow.
It's like English and like Scotland English.
Yeah.
It's like American and Scotland English.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand that most of the time.
Well, listen, most Scots don't understand it either. So it's okay.
But I mean, that would be, I guess, another thing as well, that, you know, he could have actually been functionally fluent in something, but it was maybe not just German.
The other direction in this theory that might be out there is, you know, there's the whole thing where Hermy tried to collect the pension. But if Frank himself really was part of the Seventh, you would think that he would try to get what was owed him. And there have been theories that say, well, he didn't do it because he was just so well off that he didn't need it. Or there's also the idea that, well, he didn't do it because he was so embarrassed about what happened.
Yeah.
And this is I'm putting this in between the two theories because I don't really know which direction it goes.
Well, it might be that... It might be, too, that after his experience at the Little Bighorn, he decided he wasn't that keen on being in the military.
Mm-hmm.
He'd gone back in and said, well, hey, I'm still alive. They'll say, hey, that's great. We're going to put you back in with the 7th again. You can go back out and, you know, you do your thing again. And he didn't want to do that. So in that sense, he might actually have used this incident to actually desert, actually leave the army.
Right.
Because he was presumed dead.
Which would then say that no wonder he didn't try to claim his pension because he deserted.
Yeah, and he might have just decided, this army thing is not working out.
That's probably a good point for us to transition over to theory number two, which is that Frank Finkel was a fraud.
Could have been.
And he wasn't actually at the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
No. Okay. He wouldn't be the first, would he?
No, he would not. It turns out, and this is boggling to me, that 120 people up until, I guess, about 1930 were claiming that they were there in some fashion to... I don't understand that. It's a claim for fame, I guess, but it's just, it's so weird to me. I don't get it, but... Their stories come out in one of about 5 different ways. And one of these will sound familiar to you, as you have learned from Mr. Finkel's story. But those ways are that they were the last one to be dispatched for reinforcements and or supplies. They hid in a log, an animal, or behind a rock. They charged the enemy and somehow got through. Ding, 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 Mr. Finkel. They got to the battle site late because of some kind of mishap, or they were captured and held enemy by the American Indians and for some duration of time before they escaped.
I kind of doubt that one.
Okay, well, let's just take these in order.
I don't think they took prisoners, did they?
Well, let's just take these in orders, though, Joe. So the last one dispatched, we pretty well know who the dispatched people were. People who hid, well, that's mostly hooey, except for one that we'll talk about.
Well, actually, the Indians were, you know, I mean, they were so dumb. It was very easy to fool them by hiding behind a rock. They were totally fooled by that.
I love your sarcasm. I have to call it out as sarcasm, though, because sometimes people don't get the sarcasm. No, that's a dumb theory. But the hiding in things, as we'll find, is real. Mm. Charging through the enemy, that's what Finkel says he did. Got to the battle site late. There's some guys that basically it's the same thing. Remember how we said Finkel was so big his horse was slowed down?
Yeah.
It's that kind of vein of or train of thought.
Oh, I got the bad horse this day.
Yeah, I got the crap. I got the Yugo of horses.
Or the horse, the horse has got a problem, you know, through a shoe or something like that.
Something like that. Ran lame. And then they were captured and held prisoner. Mm. That one completely holds no water because the Native Americans, they didn't take prisoners.
They
would have to feed you and house you and take care of you. No. Screw that.
Yeah, exactly.
There was no Geneva Convention. They just said, hi, thanks.
That's
You're
kind
done.
Of one of the reasons why back in the day here in America, the white people also didn't send you away to prison for a lot of crimes. They just strung you up.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were poor and we didn't have the resources to build jails and prisons and stuff like that. So,
absolutely.
You know, so hang them.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. So
let's move through things here. So there is a guy that I did not talk about earlier, and he is one of the scouts for Custer.
Yeah, one of the crows.
And that's Curly. His name is Curly.
Curly Crow?
Nope.
I don't think that's what they called him, Joe.
Probably not.
But they called him Curly. Well, Curly was a scout, and there's a couple of different versions about how his story went. But Curly became, after the fact, a popular figure, and he was paid to travel around by white people to tell his story of the events that happened at the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Of course he was.
And, well, you know, people are weird. They like gory stories. He basically, his story, from the way I understand it, there's two versions of it. Either he was sent to go get reinforcements, so he was dispatched and gone before the massacre happened, or he was still there, realized that the U.S. forces were SOL, gutted his own horse and climbed in inside of it, Tauntaun style, a la the Empire Strikes Back.
Stinky but warm.
Yes, and hid until the locals had disappeared, the forces that were there were gone, and then got out and got away with a nice bronze dark red tan. You know, that nice intestinal tan that one gets from seeping in a horse.
That would be a long, unpleasant way.
He told the story everywhere. I don't know which version is right, and I'm not even going to go into it, because he's one of many.
Probably depended on the crowd.
What's that?
Probably depended on the crowd. Which
probably
story
did
he told.
Depend. On a crowd of gentlemen and ladies, he probably told the more mundane. In a drunken room, he probably told the more gory version, because they really got into it. You're probably right.
I thought that the Crow Scouts actually parted ways with Custer before the battle. They reported back to him and said, okay, that's all we know. We'll see you later. And that's what I
probably
thought.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's the hard part with Curly, is that Curly is saying, oh, yeah, no, he stuck by him till nearly the
end. Maybe. I could be wrong. It could be some of the scouts took off, and maybe he stuck around.
The larger contingent. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so let's move to another figure that we haven't talked about as well. So there was Curly, who we hadn't talked about in the He's a Fraud. There's also a guy by the name of Daniel Kniep. Do you think that's how you say it?
Canape.
Canape? Kniep?
I say Kniep. I don't know.
Kniep? Okay, Kniep. I'm going to call him Kniep.
Okay.
She says Canape. He says Kniep. We're going to just keep moving on for the night. Okay, nobody liked that.
Kniep?
All right, Kniep.
How about Canape? Canape.
So this guy, Daniel, he wrote about finding the body of his friend, Frank Finkel, the day after that of the battle, and on the field and said, hey, I found him and I buried him. But honestly, Daniel Kniep, his story is hugely discredited by everybody because he completely screws every detail of the day up in his writing.
But what's his connection? Was he one of Custer's?
He was there. So he was part of the 7th.
But he just wasn't under Custer's direct command.
He wasn't in that 200.
Oh, so he was in one of the other
200. He was in the general 600, but he wasn't in that one-third bunch that Custer took with him. But the problem is that his story is so absolutely effed up that he talks about the wounds that Custer had on his body, and they're nowhere near the wounds that are officially recorded as of Custer having had. So he's completely off the market in the things that he has in his book.
Okay.
There's a gentleman by the name of Samuel Alcott. Alcott wrote about the body.
Was he another one of
he
the...
He was another one that was... he was
the
also,
lucky ones.
He was also one of the lucky ones that was not in that group of 200. He wrote about the fact that he and Finkel were friends. So what happened is they both came in from... So Finkel was in the 7th. Alcott was in one of those other divisions that was all kind of traveling up the Yellowstone River at the same time.
Yeah.
And they were both clerks. And so they got to know each other and they rose through the ranks together. And so he knew Finkel very well. And he said that he went back to the battle site and he found the body of his friend Frank Finkel. And he didn't personally bury him, but other men who were there did bury him. And by the way, they buried almost every man on that site. They did it really fast.
Yeah, probably mass grave, sort of.
Sort of, yeah. But they got them all in the ground rather than leaving them out in the air to the elements.
Well, that was good of them.
Well, yeah. That shows respect. You know, instead of saying, well, sorry, dude, sucks to be you and just beating feet out of the town.
Yeah.
But he says that, listen, I knew who he was. I could identify him and I found his body there. We talked about this before. There is the stories of people charging into the lines of the oncoming American Indians. The whole long spears charging in kind of a suicidal run.
Yep.
And the fact that one got through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I said before, the stories, the initial stories or the actual stories from the tribes that were there say that, oh yeah, they got through, but we hunted them all down. And the one guy that we didn't catch and kill ourselves, yeah, we didn't kill him because he died. He died and fell off his horse,
right,
so we
like
didn't
maybe
have to
they
do
tracked,
it.
They tracked him and
exactly
found him dead.
They tracked every man who broke through the line. So
well, typically they did, maybe in this particular situation, of course. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's always possible that one guy got through and they thought they tracked him down and they didn't.
Yeah.
Or, they didn't even notice in the...
In the brouhaha. Well,
yeah.
They would have noticed, but, and on general principles, it's not a good idea to let somebody go through your lines and, like, get behind you. That's not a great idea.
Oh, yeah, because he can turn around and just start firing, and
nobody
likes a bullet in the back.
Oh, no, not at all.
It doesn't do good things.
No.
Okay, it's all good, it's all bad theory, says that, well, you remember the guys that nursed him back to health?
Mm-hmm.
The trappers, Bill mm-hmm. and Mr. Tuberculosis.
Yeah.
It's a weird fact that he remembers the name of Bill, but he does not remember the name of the man that died because he says that he lived with them for at least a month, if not two.
For a while before. I didn't think the guy with tuberculosis lived that long. Did he live for a month or two?
The things that I have read gave me the impression that it was at least a month or two.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, you think he would have learned his name. Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah, it's a weird... And I'm not the only one who said, like, that's really weird that you'd remember the name of one man and not the other. It makes you think that it was a hastily concocted bit of information. Oh, and then I met Bill. Oh, but by the way, there was this guy with tuberculosis, but he died. And I don't remember his name.
Well,
of course, nobody cares about somebody with tuberculosis, so who cares?
If the guy's dying, why learn his name? I can just picture, like, in the cab, and it's like, it's like, hey there, dying guy. What's, you hungry?
More than that, if he is dying, right, and he's sick, and mm-hmm. he's pretty much just unconscious the entire time or sleeping the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And he has never, and Frank is injured himself. And maybe there was no really.
He's in and out of consciousness enough.
Yeah,
and
so maybe there was no actual interaction. And then Bill was just kind of like my buddy over here.
Yeah, yeah. The dying guy. And also, if he'd made it up, then he'd think he would have made up a name for the guy. He easily could have.
It's true,
right? Yeah,
it was Bill and Ted.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
It was totally Ted.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was Ted right there. Aim for the cat, Ted.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that was him. So let's circle back to, because I know we talked about this several times, but let's circle back to the German language bit.
Yeah.
And I know this bores the crap out of Joe,
but I think
it's funny is that...
I thought his English was supposed to be supposedly good, though.
That's the thing, is that according to Alcott, his English was actually pretty crappy. And that's not the word I wanted to use, But if his English was that bad, and they describe it as saying that he used made up and wrong words, and he would string things together into sentences that were nonsensical, like he done dooted to dooba 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 did that. Mm-hmm. And that almost is a literal translation of things that I've read.
Uh-huh.
That makes no sense. Well, if he truly knows how to speak the English language, then he is putting on an amazing act for 4 years. Because, by the way, he's been in for 4 years before the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And I haven't read anything that said that Finkel and Dayton, Washington, had a horrid, horrid accent, and then he, you know, made great strides over time to be this fluent English speaker. Well, like,
when did he show up in Dayton?
I don't have a date.
Do you have a sense,
Dayton,
even?
Dayton. I have a sense that he had been there for at least 20 years.
Okay. Because, I mean, you know, 4 years isn't very long time, but 20 years, you know, if after he got out of the military, he had gone someplace, became more and more fluent.
I would say 4 years of immersion learning of any language, you'd speak it a hell of a lot better at the end of the 4 years.
Totally. But you still might not speak it well.
But that's the thing is that if after 4 years, he's still saying, I do doodin do 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 do.
Well, maybe he had a speech impediment too. Who knows?
Okay. I don't think it was a speech impediment. Because if you read the things where he's making up these crazy sentences, it just sounds like that he just didn't get to the new language at all.
Yeah.
And so that I actually have a huge problem with if what Alcott is saying is right. Mm-hmm. I really, it's a huge nail against Frank Finkel from Dayton, Washington, because that's just such a, even with 40 years, it just seems like so, I have a hard time lining the two up.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I could sit here and talk about it all day, but we should just move on, I guess.
Okay.
No, I mean, you guys like that issue. I mean, yeah, we'll do a special bonus episode.
There we go. Let's see. The other things against Frank Finkel being there is the fact that he did not attend the reunion, which specifically had a man named Charles Windolph in attendance. Windolph said that he knew the Finkel that was at the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Yeah, he was mentioned before.
So our Frank Finkel didn't go to this event with him as if he was avoiding meeting the man
or,
that he knew he didn't know.
He never heard of the reunion.
When was that, though?
Yeah. I don't have a clear
sense
of the date.
Was it after, like, 1920 when he came out with this
story? Yes, it was after he came forward, but I don't have a clear sense of the date. Like, you know, was it 2 months after he came out, or was it 8 years after? I don't have a clear sense of that, because unfortunately the reading always says, and he declined to attend this event, and it never says,
maybe he was sick.
The date on
but it. But do you know where the event was?
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing. It's like the guy lives clear on the West Coast, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean,
I can't find, like, what I just described is exactly how it always is listed, so
I mean,
have no idea.
That's why it's annoying, right? It's like, maybe it's right when his wife was dying.
Yeah.
You know?
Or I could see this Windolph guy, or I could stay with my dying Delia.
Or maybe everything was just honky-dory, but it was harvest season, or maybe he just didn't feel like traveling 2,000 miles
maybe
in 1920.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he's like, in retrospect, he's like, that was a guy that was a total jerk. And he told me to go with Custer. I lost rock, paper, scissors to him to go with Custer.
I know. There's that, too. But, yeah, I just think, you know, people forget, travel back in those days was a lot harder than it is today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's see. What are I've got two last bullet points in here. They're not actually bullet points. I know Devin got really excited when I said that, but there's last two points here about the he is actually not telling the truth theory, which is, if you remember, I said that Hermie Finkel, his second wife, said that, he enlisted under this name Frank Hall, which is completely different than everything that we've talked about so far before. Well, there's a huge issue with that. And she was really, really big on pushing that theory. But the problem, of course, is that there was a Frank Hall.
I'm sure there were many Frank Halls.
There was a well-known Frank Hall. There's an obvious Frank Hall in the time frame in the 7th Cavalry. The problem is that that Frank Hall was 5.5 feet tall. He was 14 years older than our Frank Finkel. And, oh, by the way, he deserted the 7th a year before the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Yeah.
So he's completely not in the storyline or the story arc. So I think that's, I mean, if Delia had, or not Delia, but if Hermie had said, oh, well, he must have been under August, mm-hmm. maybe she'd have had something to go on. But she honed in on this Frank Hall idea. And that seems to be what screwed her up. And that also seems to kind of torpedo the whole Frank Finkel story, because everybody says, well, she must have gotten that from him. Like, he must have said, oh, this is what I really did.
It's just so weird, though, because it sounds like the story is when he was telling it, he was August Finkel. Mm-hmm. And there was that Sergeant August Finkel that, like, for all they knew, totally could have been him. It's just so weird that she would just continue to push that he was Frank Hall.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't speak for her.
Of course
I can't
not.
Say what the heck was going through her mind when yeah. she started going. I mean, maybe he was a doddering old fool, and she didn't really pay him that much attention until after he died, and she went, "Oh hell, I really should have listened to what he said."
Or maybe,
because I want the money now.
Or maybe he knew that she had kind of only married him for his money and was like,
"Ah, screw you."
Yeah.
That would be the best way to get a gold digger back.
Oh, for yeah. sure it would.
But the fact that there's so much confusion surrounding his history, you know, doesn't totally shoot the whole thing down.
I agree with that.
When it comes to the Battle of the Little Bighorn and Custer's Last Stand, nobody seems to agree on anything.
Yeah.
And
that's absolutely
the battle
true.
And everything. I mean, nobody knows exactly what happened at Custer's Last Stand. I mean, you know, so the popular conception is they you know had their last stand on a hilltop, but nobody's really even totally sure about that. There's some archaeological evidence that you know from the disposition of the bodies, et cetera, that says maybe not. You know.
Well, I mean, yeah, and there's arguments that actually Custer was shot and killed in the river and his men drug his body to where it was found. I mean, this is going deep into the weeds about the Custer conspiracy, which is a completely different story.
Absolutely different.
But yeah. it's the whole thing is just so it's I equate it to somebody drawing the Mona Lisa on an Etch-a-Sketch and then shaking the crap out of it and saying, "Put it back together."
Yeah, that's
there's no way.
Yeah, so we'll never really know.
No,
until we invent a wayback machine, and we can send people back to be there and hope they don't get killed. That's why
I'm not
going to
go in
person.
Hey, Devin, you don't have anything going on. Build us a wayback machine.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So there's one other thing that I want to talk about that is a knock against Frank and his story, and that is his last name. And the fact that his last name is spelled a bajillion different ways, and not by the internet, mind you, but by him over the years.
Yeah.
So he spells his name in different documentation over the years, Finkle. He then starts spelling it Finkel, and then later on, Finckel. So his spelling of his name, Finkel to Finkel to Funkel, like it goes all over the map, and that doesn't make it feel like he knew what his own name was. Like, why would it morph that much?
It would suggest to me that it was an alias from the get go. I mean, like, you know, he adopted it later, much later in life. It was not his birth name. Yeah,
and so if he has a couple of beers, you know, I forget how to spell my name after a couple of beers. Sometimes,
I can only spell my name because you know I've been having it pounded into my head since I was, you know, 3 years old or something. You know?
Yeah,
well, I mean, I guess the argument could be made that if he really if the story of being an immigrant child is true, you know, this happened to my family when they came over. They changed their name on Ellis Island. But, you know, if you came over when you were 6 or 7, you'd been used to spelling your name one way. suddenly your name's spelled a different way, goes back and forth all the time, you know, or you decide like, you know what, we're just going to start spelling it that old way again. You know, I want to go back to my roots. That's fine. And then you realize that was dumb. What, you know, there are just a lot of little things that can happen. I'm not saying they did happen or they didn't happen, but I'm at least willing to say that there's some flexibility in there.
And remember, today we sign our names a hell of a lot more than people did back then. Writing was a luxury.
I was going to say, there could have also been some literacy things going on.
Yes, I mean, you didn't write your name every day. If you use a credit card or go to some place where they print out a receipt and you have to say, I probably sign my name a half dozen times a week without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And if you go back in history 100 years ago, you signed your name maybe a half dozen times a year.
I have a friend whose signature is an intentional misspelling of their name in order to be able to say, like, I spell my name this way when I sign it. So if somebody were to fake the signature, they would be able to say, well, it's spelled correctly and I don't spell my name correctly.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, it could be something as crazy as that. Probably not, but...
Listen, I'm lucky I haven't gotten in trouble with the U.S. government because I write out my middle name so infrequently that I actually invert the letters in my... we've talked about this.
Maybe it's that.
I invert the letters in my middle name wife is like, wait, how did you spell that? You know that's not how it's spelled.
It is
really?
Now.
Well, it turns out I've been doing it wrong for this long, so we're going to just run with it.
Totally.
So, okay. You guys got which things in the theories do you like? I know people enjoy that, so I want to know what you guys think.
Right, I'm going to go with he was there. Okay. Somebody had to survive that, right?
I'm agreeing. He was there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to say that he was not there. Mm-hmm. If the story of why he came forward is what it is, I think it's bogus. And I really feel like he might have been we've encountered these people. He's a connoisseur of a certain story.
Yeah.
And he got ahead of himself. And then once fame hit him, he couldn't retract it.
Yeah.
So I actually think that he probably wasn't there.
Mm, I think he was.
Okay. Well, you, our dear listeners, are welcome to share your opinions on this with us.
And of course, if you were there, we want to hear from you especially.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
I do. Because holy hell, how old are you?
Yeah.
But you are welcome to share your opinions with us. There's a multitude of ways to do that. You could do it on social media, because we have the Facebook page and the Facebook group. If you want to do that in the group, you got to join the group. And to join the group, you got to answer the questions. They're very simple. I'm not actually going to provide you the answers because you already know them. They're that easy. You can get a hold of us on Twitter where we are Thinking Sideways. You can tweet your answer in a very short, sporadic way. Or you could just go to Twitter and look at the really funny stuff that we put up, a.k.a. Devin puts up.
Yeah.
We're also on Instagram. Don't send us a message on Instagram because Instagram's about pictures, not words. But Devin also puts up funny stuff on Instagram.
All hilarious things.
So funny.
So good.
If you want to actually write words to us in fewer than 200 and some odd characters, you can do so through an email. You can send us an email at thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com where you can send us your thoughts on this story, thoughts on any story, story suggestions, opinions about the show, general feedback, nothing negative because we don't like the negative, but we love the positive. Send us whatever you want. I don't really
just
care.
Just be nice to us. We're real humans.
Just generally we're people. We're
negative
humans.
Is okay, actually. Yeah. We need feedback. You know,
we're
we'll
humans.
Take it.
So
yeah.
Send us whatever you want at that email address. By the way, if you want to read some of the research for this particular story, that will be on our website, and that is thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. We'll have links for this story as well as all past stories. You can listen to the story there. You can download it there. By the way, there's an episode list on the website. You can see chronologically all stories that we've done.
You can also find links to merch.
Yes, because on the website we have both Zazzle and Redbubble, links to them, so you can find the shirts and the mugs and the t-shirts and hoodies.
Nightlights.
Oh, yeah.
God, I can't believe we still
have
about
the
stickers.
Yeah.
We have all... God, how long ago did we make that?
A long time ago.
People are still buying it because it's awesome.
Yeah.
calm. By the way, I talked about streaming and downloading off of the website. You can also do that anywhere that you get podcasts. So if you use Apple Podcasts, you can do it there. If you use Stitcher, you can do it there. Google Play, you can do it there. If you're on a site that allows you to leave a comment and a review, please do so, because that helps other folks find us. Of course, you know, subscribe while you're there. If you're on Stitcher, or, well, actually, if you're not on Stitcher, just so you know, we're going to let you in on a little deal. We're on Stitcher Premium. If you're a Stitcher Premium member, you'll get the episodes 4 days early. You'll get the episodes ad-free. And by the way, we put out monthly bonus content. So these things are all available to premium members. If you're not a premium member and you want to become one, you can go to stitcher.com/thinkingsideways. Use the promo code sideways and you get 1 month free plus a whole bunch of other stuff. Now, by the way, that month free, that requires that you sign up for the 12-month plan. If you do the monthly plan, well, I'm afraid it doesn't take effect. Damn. So just so you know how that works, that's really all that we've got. So I think that we need to build a little defensive fort out of cats, because there's cats in this house.
No dead animals.
No. Listen, they're cats. They love to just lay in kind of a pile, because that's what cats do. So we're going to hide behind those cats. It's cat fort.
Okay.
You're not playing along, dude.
Dude, they're my cats. You can't shoot at my cats.
I just told you, we're not going to shoot at your cats. They're just cats. They like to pile up.
The other side's going to shoot at them. Yeah.
It's cat pile. Okay, yeah. Devin, you got anything to share?
I'm going
to
go hide in a horse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to go hide behind a car door. That always stops bullets.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you, Han Solo. Thank you, Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
And we will talk to you people next week.
Toodaloo, folks.
It was Luke, not Han.